Esther chapter 2, we're continuing our series. This is a second sermon in the book of Esther, so we'll be reading Esther chapter 2, and I'll read that in just a minute. If you don't have your Bible, you can pick one up in the pew back in front of you and find Esther. As we begin this sermon, I almost titled it Providence in the Palace. That was almost the title. That's not the title. If you're writing notes, that's not the title. But I almost titled that because as you look at chapter 2, at the most basic level, this chapter is setting the stage for the rest of the book. It is putting all the main pieces and people in the correct places so that the story can unfold. And specifically, as we'll see, so that the protection of God's people through the two characters we're introduced to here might be accomplished. That's the main purpose of Esther chapter 2, how God is putting these people into places so that his plan can unfold. But the more closely I looked at the chapter, and as I considered how to preach Esther chapter 2, I realized it's a bit more complicated than that. It's not just a simple, straightforward understanding of God's providence in the palace. Because the more you think about the events of this chapter and these specific characters, the more difficult the questions arise that you have to deal with. And what we're going to see is that the chapter itself doesn't give a lot of answers. There's a lot there's a lack of clarity here. Chapter 2 is not set or aimed at giving specific answers to a lot of the questions, at least I had. Instead, there are a lot of questions left unanswered. Thus, the title of the sermon is Perplexing Providence. Perplexing Providence. I almost made it Perplexing Providence in the Palace. So if you want to write that down, you can, but that's what I stuck with, Perplexing Providence. The big takeaway as we leave Esther chapter 2, the big takeaway is not simply that God's providence is present here in the palace, but that God's providence is present in the palace in a way that's perplexing or confusing or hard to understand. And what I hope to show you is that it's almost always impossible to read God's providence, or to know exactly what God is up to in his doings. In this chapter, as the events are unfolding, there's no way that the individuals in these chapters, or in this chapter, as they're doing what they're doing, that they know or are aware of the actions that they're part of and taking, that there's no way for them to know where their actions are leading. As Esther is going through the events of this chapter, there's no way that she knows that these events are going to lead to the deliverance of God's people. She just doesn't know. She can't know. It's often an impossible task to look around you, your current circumstances, or to look into the future and to think that you can know what God is doing. It's an impossible task because God's providence is perplexing. And it is in Esther too, but it's in your life also. Think about a situation where you were going through something difficult, a challenging circumstance. Maybe it's relational conflict. You don't know how to move forward. Or maybe you're facing a life-altering decision. This job, this path, that path. Marry this person, marry that person. What course of action to take? Health-related, career-related, child-related. In all these situations and more, you don't know what God is up to in your life. Suffering, the list could go on. You can't look around, or you can't look into the future and know, here's why this is happening. Or here's what God is doing in my life right now. You can't do that. Because God's providence is perplexing. Now, it's one thing to know and believe that God is in control, which the Bible teaches, which we'll see. But it's another thing to think that because you believe God's in control, that you'll know or understand everything that God's doing in your life at all times. That is not something the Bible teaches. His providence is perplexing. So we'll see that here in Esther. You can follow along. I'm going to read all of the chapter right now at the outset, and then we'll pray, and then we'll work through the verses together. But you can follow along as I read Esther chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. This is what God's word says. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and how and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother had died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace. And he advanced her, he's talking about Esther, and let her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Verse 12, now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shaagaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again, unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. Verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, when her time came to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. Verse 19, now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Let's pray, and then we'll walk through this chapter together. Father, I ask that as we study this chapter, Esther chapter 2, this word that's been given to us by you, been preserved for us, given by your Spirit and preserved for us, I pray that you would help us to benefit from its hearing. Help us to be taught by your word. That's in Christ's name I pray. Amen. All right, well, as we go through this chapter, there's 4 points that we're going to walk through. And so let me give you the 4 points here at the outset, and then we'll walk through them one at a time. So the replacing the queen, verses 1-4. The rise of Esther, which that sounded like a Star Wars title to me, but it's not. It's just the rise of Esther, verses 5-11, our second point. Then a new queen, verses 12-18. And then finally, kind of a transition from chapter 2-3 is a plot against the king, which Mordecai hears, which is verses 19-23. So let's work through those, beginning first point, replacing the queen. So chapter 1 precedes chapter 2, and the events of chapter 1 are what help us make sense of how chapter 2 begins. King Ahasuerus, he's now, we find in chapter 2, he's now more sober-minded than he was in chapter 1. He's not angry anymore. If you remember chapter 1, he's very angry at his wife who did not obey him. And so he made an edict that she would never come into his presence again and published an edict over all the provinces. Well, he's calmed down now that the alcohol is out of his system, and he realizes he doesn't have a queen. And it's almost certain that he regrets what he's done in banishing Vashti. So he's upset. He realizes what's going on. And just like in chapter 1, instead of him saying, okay, here's what's going to happen, it's others. This time it's young men around him who dictate what he's going to do. So in verse 2, it's the king's young men who tell him what must be done. And in their plan is to find a replacement queen for King Ahasuerus. And they say, there's three qualifications. All the young women, all the beautiful women, and all the virgins, all the young, beautiful virgins in all of your kingdom, all 127 provinces, get them all together and come here to your town, to your citadel, to Susa. And then from all of them, you have the choice to decide who the next queen is. And they have a bit of a contest ordered for the deciding of who's going to be the next queen. And so in their plan, the young woman, whoever of all of the women of the empire that come, the young woman who pleases the king the most should be made queen. So that's the plan. Now this would be a departure from the normal royal proceedings, because often when you're looking to replace a queen, you look for her pedigree or her lineage. But here they say, no, we're not going to worry about that. We don't care what family she comes from. All that we care about is if she's physically attractive and that she's able to please the king. That's their plan. And this king, unsurprisingly, says, hey, that sounds like a great plan. And so he follows the advice of others and puts this plan into motion. And so as we just begin here at the outset of chapter 2, in this beauty contest, or this contest for queen, I simply want you to recognize that no one involved here, and I mean no one, is acting with a conviction that the God of Israel is at work in their midst. The Lord is not on the minds of Ahasuerus or these young men or anyone else. And yet, as we'll see, this very contest is what sets the stage for the new queen. This contest that was suggested to the king by these young men is the very thing that God is using to put the right person in the right place for his purposes. While no one in this situation has any idea what's going on. I mean, we just have to recognize that. That leads to the second point, the rise of Esther, verses 5 through 11. So here we finally get to meet the namesake of this book and her uncle. So we're introduced to two main characters, the two main protagonists of Esther there in verse 5. There's a Jew in Susa whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. And notice verse 6. This man was carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. And so this man, this Benjaminite, which will come into play next week in the first verse of chapter 3, he's a Benjaminite. He's of the line of King Saul. But for now, the focus is on the fact that he's been carried away. Three times in that verse, he's been carried away, carried away, carried away. Which is to say, he is an exile. And his identity is defined by his exile. He's not Persian. He's an exiled Jew living in a foreign land. And we know that there were Jews who had been exiled who under Cyrus were sent back and allowed to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and the wall. But Mordecai, for whatever reason, had not returned. Now, some people say that Mordecai is in the wrong here because he's still there. They say that that's a problem, that that's sin, that he had not returned. And that his presence here is evidence of his total assimilation into the Persian culture. That's possible, but the text just doesn't say. This is one of those questions. It doesn't answer. It just says, here he is. He's in exile, and he finds himself in the Persian court, in the city of Susa. But it's not just Mordecai. We're told in verse 7, he's bringing up Hadassah. That is her Hebrew name. Her Persian name is Esther. That's where the title of the book comes from. So Esther is the daughter of Mordecai's uncle. So this is his cousin. And he had taken her in. When her father and mother had died, he adopted her. It's obvious that he's much older than her, and so he adopts her as his own daughter. And so she, like Mordecai, is a Jew. She's an exile, which will be an important part in this book as it unfolds. In fact, she's keeping it silent. She's keeping it silent all through chapter 2. You saw two instances where that's mentioned and brought attention to. That's because her ethnic identity is going to be a big part of how this story unfolds. But more than her being Jewish, the point that's made in verse 7 is that she had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. The author of Esther wants us to know that. And after he says that, or the author says that, we aren't surprised to find that the beautiful young Esther is taken into the custody of the king to be part of this search for the next queen. She lives there in the capital city, and she is part of this gathering of these young women. But we quickly learn in verse 9 that there's something different about Esther. And we see that there's something different in that she won the favor of the king's eunuch, whose name is Hegai. She earns his favor. So this is the man in charge of all of these women who are coming to become the next queen, all vying for this position. And this man is in charge of all of them. And she earns the favor or wins the favor of this man. And so what that means is she gets all the best cosmetics or the best beauty treatments. She gets special food. She gets 7 young women attendants given specifically to her. And she's given the best place in the harem, or maybe your translation says in the house of women. So she finds favor, and now she's getting all these benefits. And so this young Jewish woman, for some reason, certainly unknown to her at this point, is rising in favor with the king's eunuch who's in charge of these women. And as we read this, there are certainly a number of differences, but this is somewhat reminiscent of, think of Daniel in the court of Nebuchadnezzar. And he just wins the favor of those in charge. And okay, you can have that special diet. I'll let you do that. Or think of Joseph in the court of Pharaoh. He just rises to power. And so there's similarities in that these young Jewish exiles are favored by those in authority and they rise to power. And we see in every case it's to accomplish God's purposes. But that's the case here in Esther, though she is unaware of it at this point. The last thing we find out about Esther is that though she was Jewish exile, she was told by Mordecai not to tell anyone. Again, we don't know why Mordecai gave her this command. There's a lot of speculation, but all we know for sure is that Esther listens to him and no one knows that she's a Jew. And so while Esther is here in the house of women, this place where they're in waiting, they're being prepared for their time with the king, we learn that Mordecai is there around and he's able to check in on her every day to see what's happening. And so that's the rise of Esther. She's rising in this house of women. But again, before we move to point 3, we see the events unfolding in the lives of Mordecai and Esther with no awareness or apparent concern for what God's doing in these events. Esther has been placed in the king's custody, and Mordecai has told her not to tell anyone about her Jewish ethnicity, but no one is aware of how these unfolding events are going to play into God's bigger plan. They have no idea. Again, that's the point. But we as readers find, as we move to this next point, that Esther is going to be the next queen. So look there, point 3, a new queen, verses 12 through 18. As we turn to this third point, this is where the passage gets a bit uncomfortable. And it gets uncomfortable because we're told how the whole process is going to play out. Which means that for Esther to become queen means for her to go into the king and please him more than any other woman, any other young woman that have been brought to the capital for this specific purpose. I mean, that's the contest. And verses 12 through 14 say, each of these young, beautiful women, now no one knows for sure how many this were, it could be hundreds, could be, someone speculated thousands, but all these women go through a 12-month beautification process. All of them. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments. These are ways of beautifying or preparing them to smell good, to be whatever it does. It's a preparation process. And I think the point is there's 12 months of preparation for one night with the king. It's a bit of an overreaction. It's a bit much here. But as this contest plays out, when it's time for a specific woman to go into the king, she'd go into the king, she could take whatever she wanted, and she'd spend the night with him, and then in the morning, she'd be sent to another group of women. And these women, under the charge of another eunuch, were the concubines of the king, which was basically a group of women who would have been considered secondary wives, property of the king, not on the level of queen, but still property and wives of the king. And so that's these hundreds or thousands of women. That's what happens. They prepare for 12 months, they go in for one night with the king, and then they're sent away never to see the king again. Which means that by taking part in this contest, whether they were forced to be contestants or whether they willingly chose, we don't know. People speculate about that. We don't know, but what we do know is that these women, when they join this contest, they never go back to their families or homes. They come and they vie to be queen, and if they are not queen, they are at least part of the king's harem of women after that. And so we find Esther, verse 16, her turn to come to the king comes. This is verse 16. Esther is taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Verse 17, it says simply, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Just like that, Esther is queen. And that's all we're told. Esther is queen. The result of her one night with King Ahasuerus is that he loved Esther more than all the other women. And she is made queen in the place of Vashti. And the text is straightforward, but it's still a bit vague. We're not told exactly how Esther earns the love of the king. We don't really have to wonder. We know the nature of the contest, but the thing that the text does make clear is that the king loved Esther. And this the word here, loved, is deeper than just delighting in her, which was mentioned earlier. This is a deeper love than one might expect in this context. But this king, after his time with Esther, loves her. I think it appears that just like with the king's eunuch, Esther is quickly earning the favor of the king and the devotion and love of King Ahasuerus. And so he makes her king. Contest is over. And the result of him finding a new queen is a feast, which as we go through this book, feasts are going to mark all the major events. Remember chapter 1, there was a feast that led to the casting out of Vashti. Well, here, there's a feast when the replacement is found. And this celebration is Esther's feast. The king is so happy, taxes are stopped to celebrate this new queen. And so as the events of chapter 2 unfold, we have this young Jewish girl who's risen from the house of Mordecai to the throne of Persia. And she finds herself in the place of queen, which again sets the stage for what's going to happen next. But again, I know this is a repetitious thing. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but throughout the whole process, Esther doesn't know what God's doing. When her parents died, when she was adopted by Mordecai, when she was taken into the house of women, when she went into the king, in all these events, she doesn't know that she's going to replace Queen Vashti, but that is where she ends up. And now that she's queen, she doesn't know what her purpose is. But as this book unfolds, she will find out, she will know her why, but through this process thus far, she's left to wonder at God's perplexing providence. She couldn't say, oh, I know what God's doing. She has no idea, but God is still at work through the events of chapter 2. That leads to the final section, this transition, this passage that bridges chapter 2 to chapter 3. And it records what will be a very significant event in the rule of Ahasuerus. And so look, finally, a plot against the king. So you see there verses 19 through 23. So in these verses, we see Mordecai, who happens to overhear two of the king's officials talking. So they're two of the king's officials, and they're angry with the king. We don't know why, but they want to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. They want to kill him. They're angry at him, and Mordecai overhears their discussion. And so when he hears that, he knows someone who can do something about this. So he tells Esther what he heard. So Esther then goes to the king in the name of Mordecai and says, here's a report. Here's the word on the street, king. And the king then goes and investigates and finds that it's true, that these men are planning to kill him. And both of these officials are hanged immediately, which again, that will be a theme that runs through this book. But they are immediately killed because of their disloyalty. And it tells us that these events are recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king, which is significant because what it means is Mordecai's not going to be recognized here. That's abnormal. In a situation like this, when something like this happened, the man who showed loyalty to the king and preserved his life would have been recognized and honored immediately. But for whatever reason, Mordecai's overlooked now. He had proved his loyalty to the Persian king, and he rightfully deserved recognition. But in this instance, at this time, this deed goes unnoticed. and would be unnoticed until just the right time. It was recorded so that it will come up again, but at this time it is overlooked. And that is how chapter 2 ends until we're introduced in chapter 3, setting the stage for the antagonist to be introduced. And so as we come to the end of Esther chapter 2, we end the chapter with the people in their places. Vashti's gone, Esther's queen. Mordecai has shown his loyalty to Ahasuerus. He still has the ear of his adopted daughter who's queen. Right? That's a relationship that's going to, a line of communication that's going to be important in the coming chapters. And we're going to see the events of Esther unfold so that Esther and Mordecai, the two people we're introduced to here, are used by God to preserve his people in exile. We will see his providence, his sovereignty clearly at work in the coming chapters. But for now, I want to leave highlighting the perplexity that often works in this world. Because that's hopefully you've seen, no one is aware of what God's doing, but the events are still unfolding according to God's plan. And so even as I was preparing for this sermon, this week I ran into a friend who I hadn't talked to in years. And I run into him, and just in catching up, he's about 12 really challenging months that he's recently had in his job. In fact, it just so happened that the day before I met him, so I ran into him on Thursday, and I guess Monday, he said, was his last day of his previous job. Again, I hadn't talked that God's providence is trustworthy. We're not in the story of Esther, but we know how it ends. So though they didn't know, we know. And so we can trust, though the providence is perplexing here, we have the benefit of the whole story knowing, oh, it worked out okay. God was working for the good of his people and for his glory throughout Esther. The fact that God is in control is something we can fall back on in times of chaos and confusion. We can trust him. I mean, the Bible, along, I'd say, with our personal lives, are full of examples where God's hidden hand is guiding all things to work together for the good of his people. As I mentioned, Joseph in Egypt, Daniel in Babylon. Think about Jesus in Jerusalem. Through perplexing events, and in all of those specific cases, he was leading towards the salvation of his people. So the second word of application for us in terms of God's perplexing providence is trust. God's people can trust God in the midst of perplexing. I mean, perhaps you're in a situation that's troubling or confusing. Or you just don't know what the right thing to do is. Maybe that's you. Maybe you're experiencing what seems to be an unending amount of suffering. In fact, as I was writing this sermon, I thought of two families in our church who feel that way right now. The suffering just isn't stopping. Maybe that's you. Or maybe you're feeling the sting of loneliness. Or you're feeling like the life you've been given to live has just lost its wonder. Right? In these situations and in many others, the hope for you is that God can be trusted. God can be trusted in the midst of your confusion or your chaos. The hope for God's people is this. When you can't see his hand, you can trust his heart. When you look around and you say, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why this is happening. When you can't see his hand, you can trust his heart. In fact, I want you to look at the pew back in front of you. There's a blue book probably in front of you. That's called a hymnal. I want you to pull out the hymnal. Don't worry, I'm not going to make you sing. But pull out the hymnal if you have one in front of you. And I want you to turn to page 73. I'm not going to make you sing. I'm not going to sing. But on page 73, there's a hymn titled God Moves Song. What this sermon, what I've been trying to communicate to you through this sermon. And so This is described as God moving in a mysterious way. That's God's perplexing providence. But I want you to look at verses 3 and 4. I want to read them, and you follow along. If you don't know how to read the hymnal, look at the person next to you and follow their finger. But number 3, follow the line, the third line there. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. In verse 4, blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain.